Chapter 11. Rose. Christmas Eve, 1979. The village never looked prettier than it did the evening I first met Daphne Hartle. Warm white lights were strung up between lampposts along the high street and twinkled against the inky sky. The church choir stood on the stone steps of the market cross and sang Silent Night in front of a huge Christmas tree, and a few rickety stalls had been set up around the edges of the village square. Melissa Brown, who owned the only cafe in Beggar's Nook, imaginatively named Melissa's, was open late to serve hot drinks and mince pies. The smell of roasted chestnuts and mulled wine filled the air. And that Christmas, you were old enough to appreciate the magic of it all.
Mummy, drink!
I looked down at you. Your little snub nose was red with the cold, and the pink scarf I'd knitted you was up to your chin. It was already dark, and not quite tea time. Why not? I smiled, clasping your soft woolen hand in my own. What about a hot chocolate? You squealed in excitement, trying to pull me across the square. And that was when I saw her. The woman who was to change my life. Although, of course, I didn't know that yet. She looked sad. That was my initial thought. She was standing alone by the market cross, blowing on her bare hands as she watched the carol singers. She was wearing a thin olive green velvet coat with colourful patches stitched onto it, and her cord flares were too loose around her thighs. She was thin, I observed, her collarbone sticking out from her shirt. A crochet berry was pressed down onto long blonde hair, parted in the middle, and she had a large bag over her shoulder. She was new to the village, I could tell. She had that look about her, and I made it my business to watch out for newcomers, even while keeping myself to myself. I had to, for my safety, and for yours. This backwater village in the depths of the Cotswolds was where people came to hide. And I recognised a kindred spirit when I saw one.
Mummy!
You urged, tugging on my hand. Sorry, Lolly, I said, pulling my gaze away from the stranger and following you into the cafe. Your huge brown eyes lit up when Melissa handed you the hot chocolate in a white polystyrene cup, whipped cream swirled on top. I laughed and told you that you'd never manage it all. Then we stood just outside the cafe, fingers curled around our warm cups, you licking the cream off the top of the hot chocolate, and me searching for her among the knot of people gathered by the Christmas tree. I could see her moving through the crowd, her shoulders hunched against the cold, her eyes darting about as though afraid. She looked like a hunted animal. Was that how I'd looked when I came to the village 3 years ago, pregnant with you and desperate for a new start? Hold on a sec, sweetheart. I just want a quick word with Melissa. I let go of your hand to step inside the cafe. Melissa Brown was a large woman with a greying bob, parted in the middle and pinned at the sides, somewhere in her 40s, old-fashioned in both her outlook and appearance. She had never been married and had lived in Beggar's Nook all her life. As a result, she knew everything about everyone. Well, mostly everyone. I knew she thought of me as an enigma because she'd said it to me on many occasions. Dear Rose, usually said when my hands were clamped between her large, clammy ones. You're such an enigma. This was often uttered after I'd avoided one of her many questions. But she had always been kind to me and had tried to involve me in village life. The cafe was quiet. Most people were still gathered by the market cross or perusing the stalls filled with colourful tinsel and garish decorations. You'd already persuaded me to buy one, a little gold fairy to put on top of the tree. Melissa, I said, lowering my voice, even though it was just me and her in the cafe. You don't know who that woman is, do you? The thin one in the crocheted hat. Melissa wiped her hands on her flowery apron and stared in the woman's direction. She shook her head.
Never seen her before. She could be from the next village. Oh, and before I forget, Nancy said someone was interested in the ad you put up in her window. You know, for the lodger.
Nancy worked in the local shop and was Melissa's younger sister. I kept the advert vague on purpose, asking Nancy to take details of any interested parties so that I could get in touch with them rather than give out my own information. I didn't even put my name on it. I couldn't risk it. That's great. I already knew that if a man had inquired, I'd never get in touch. I'd made a mistake with my last lodger. She had been the right sex, but she'd asked too many questions, wanted to be friends. So she had to go. I'll ask Nancy to pass her details on to you tomorrow, if you like. I nodded, but I was already distracted, moving away from the counter towards where I'd left you by the open door. I froze. You'd gone. I'd turned my back on you for just a few minutes. It was foolish of me. I never normally let you out of my sight. But I felt unusually safe in that moment, you see, surrounded by a collective Christmas cheer and villagers who didn't really know me, but whom I'd been watching for the last 3 years from afar to see whom I could trust. They all seemed honest, hard-working folk, salt of the earth. And I thought I could trust you, that I'd instilled it in you since you could walk, to be careful, to stay near me, not to wander off. But you were just a little girl, only 2 and a half. A little girl mesmerised by the glitziness of Christmas. You'd gone.
Lolly!
I cried, unable to keep the panic from my voice. I stepped out of the cafe and onto the street. My eyes scanned the pavements and the square, the group of carol singers who had finished their rendition of Silent Night and begun to disperse. It had been a minute, two at the most. You couldn't have got very far. Yet I couldn't see you anywhere. I couldn't see your little red coat or your pink scarf or the bright patterned bobble hat. Blood rushed to my ears. Are you okay? I could hear Melissa's voice behind me, but it felt distorted, like I was underwater.
She's gone! Lolly's gone!
I cried.
I can't see her! I can't see her anywhere!
People were milling about, laughing, talking, sipping mulled wine. I wanted to scream at them all.
Get out the way! Where is she? Where's my child?
I could feel tears at the back of my eyes, panic pressing on my chest. He's taken you. That's all I could think, over and over again, replaying like a horror film in my mind. I pushed past people, calling your name. I could sense that Melissa was behind me, trying to calm me, but I couldn't process what she was saying. I was in a panic, a blind panic. I've heard people call it that, and that's exactly how it felt. I was blinded by fear. I pushed through people, Melissa on my tail. I heard her asking them if they'd seen a little girl in a red duffel coat. And then there you were. I saw you through the crowds, holding the hand of the mysterious woman I would come to know as Daphne Hartle. You were smiling, but had dried tear tracks on your cheeks. I rushed over to you, almost snatching you away from the tall, thin woman, and bending down to your level, hugging you to me, breathing in your familiar, sweet smell.
Thank God, thank God, thank God.
I'm so sorry, the woman said. Her voice was husky. She looked lost,
so I said I'd help her find her mummy. I noticed she was clutching your polystyrene cup, the rim sticky with chocolate. I stood up, holding onto your hand, never wanting to let go of it again.
See?
Said a voice behind me. It was Melissa, her large bosoms rising up and down as she gasped for breath.
I knew, pant, pant, she'd be fine.
Thanks, Melissa. I'm sorry for the overreaction. She nodded, her hand pressed to her chest, and said it was no problem and that she'd better get back to the cafe. But she threw me a strange look over her shoulder as she went. I knew what she was thinking, that I was an overprotective mother, hysterical. There were a few beats of awkward silence, and then the woman said, I'm Daphne. Rose, and this is Lolly. She smiled, and it lit up her whole face, making her seem less severe, less angular. Now I was closer to her, I could see the tips of her long eyelashes were blue. Yes, she told me that. An unusual name. It's Lorna, but she finds it hard to say. She called herself Lolly and it's stuck. Well, thank you again. I hesitated, wondering if I should ask. Are you new to the village? She nodded. I'm staying in one of the rooms over the Stag and Pheasant, but I'm looking for lodgings, something more permanent, at least for a while. I wondered if it was her who had inquired about my ad. I might be able to help you there. I smiled at her. She smiled back shyly, flashing her small white teeth. This was serendipitous, I thought. We were supposed to meet. How wrong I was. Chapter 12. Safi. Mum is unusually quiet on the drive to see Gran. She stares out of the window as we pass the village square and the market cross and the cafe, the beggar's bowl. Beyond, the church's spire glints in the bright sunshine. It's rained overnight, and the air has a fresh, newly laundered feel, making everything look brighter and sharper. Is she thinking about Alberto? She hasn't mentioned him much. I spent most of yesterday afternoon showing her around the village as we reminisced about Gran, Tom discreetly lagging behind with Snowy. Mum instinctively seemed to know her way to the cafe, and when she walked up the crumbling stone steps of the market cross, she said she had a feeling of déjà vu. This, she said, pointing to a small building by the church. I'm sure this was a play school or Sunday school or something. I'd booked us in for Sunday lunch at the Stag and Pheasant, knowing she'd love it there as it's won awards for its food. My mum is the biggest foodie I know. She seemed unusually on edge as we walked around the cobbled streets and kept asking about how easy it was to access the woods at the back of the cottage. Mum is very rarely on edge. She's a happy-go-lucky kind of person, always looking for the bright side of a situation. When I asked her what was wrong, she'd shaken her head, nearly knocking herself out with her huge earrings, and linked her arm in mine. Nothing, my sweet girl. I love being here with you. Now, show me where that lovely gastropub is. I could murder some roast beef. Are you okay? I ask now, as we head out of the village and towards the M4. She turns to me, flashing a dazzling smile. But beneath her expertly applied makeup, she looks tired. Of course. Why? Because you're not chatting 19 to the dozen, as usual. You're just a bit quieter than usual, I say instead, wanting to be diplomatic. I'm wondering about your gran, that's all. Is she going to be lucid enough for this interview today? The sun goes in suddenly, and everything is gloomier. I'm worried about that too, I don't want her to feel frightened. But at least they're doing it at the care home. And it's good that you're not leaving until Saturday, so you can see Gran again before you go. Mum fidgets in her seat and adjusts her top. She's wearing a tight, bodice-style denim blouse that strains across her chest slightly, white jeans, and tan-coloured heeled sandals. Her toenails are freshly painted in fuchsia. I haven't done mine since Christmas. Not that it matters, as I live in trainers, even in this heat. If I ever don sandals, they're my trusty Birkenstocks, which Mum has always deemed downright ugly. I'm thinking of staying on a bit longer. She pauses. If you don't mind. I wonder what's made her decide to lengthen her stay. I'd thought a week would be more than long enough for her. Surely by then she'll be pining for Alberto and the beach. Of course I don't mind, I say. Although that's not strictly true. Mum's personality fills the cottage somehow, so that everything feels even smaller. She can't help but take over, cooking for us, even if we're not hungry, or just as we're about to unwind on the sofa, she'll chivy me to fetch some clothes that she can put in the machine. I feel guilty when she starts washing up, and feel I have to help, even though Tom and I would usually leave it until the next day, preferring to chill out in front of the TV. Tom is great with her, but I could see the strain on his face as she talked at him last night while he was trying to watch the IT crowd. What about your job? I can take some of it as unpaid leave. Anyway, they owe me lots of holiday. Okay. You know you can stay as long as you want, but I do need to work. I've got a deadline, I say, which is true, and hopefully means she'll know I haven't got time to sit around chatting all day. She reaches out and pats my knee fondly, her bracelets jangling. You don't need to worry about me. Just do the things you'd normally do and pretend I'm not here. I want to laugh. That's just not possible with my mother. Will Alberto mind? She waves a ringed hand dismissively. Leave that to me. It'll be fine. I force down my worry. I can't help but think Mum is running away from her life in Spain, from the problems she's no doubt having with Alberto. It makes me feel guilty that I have Tom and a baby on the way, when Mum has never really been able to settle. She emits a sharp laugh, which makes me jump. Darling, you look so serious. Stop worrying. I'm not. You're chewing your lip again. You always do that when you're worrying. I'm a grown woman. I'll be fine. You don't need to worry about me. I need to worry about you. I frown. Why do you need to worry about me? I meant... She twists the ring on her index finger. My dad gave it to her. It's a sapphire and beautiful. And even though they split up years ago, she never takes it off. It's just in general, you know. That's a mother's job. Why do I get the feeling there's something she isn't saying? The sun bursts from behind a cloud, bright and blinding, and I have to pull the visor down. But Mum is right. I am anxious. I'm anxious about throwing up my decaf tea and half a piece of toast, about seeing the police, about Gran's interview, about what she'll say. When we arrive, Gran is sitting in her usual chair in the corner of the day room. Sun streams through the glass, and it feels too hot and airless in here. The French windows are firmly closed, and Gran is wearing a pink jumper. She must be boiling. She's not doing a puzzle today. Instead, she just gazes out of the doors, deep in thought, at the gardens beyond. I wonder what she's thinking about. Gosh, says Mum, putting her hand to her throat. She looks so much smaller and thinner than when I last saw her. Her voice catches. I swallow my nerves and check my watch. It's just gone 10. The police said they'd arrive about 10:30. Joy, the manager of the care home, a thin, officious woman in her late 50s, strides over to where we're hovering in the doorway. Rose is having a good day, she says. She smiles, but it doesn't reach her eyes beyond her horn-rimmed glasses. She always has an air of harassment. I'll let you know when the police arrive. I don't want them coming in here and distracting the other residents. Mum nods, thanks, Joy, and we wander over to Gran. There's a cane two-seater sofa next to her, and we squash onto it together. Gran doesn't look up as we join her, continuing to gaze off into the middle distance. She has her false teeth in. I'm so used to seeing her without them that the effect changes her face shape, accentuating her jaw and making her look sterner somehow. Hi, Gran, I begin, shifting my weight towards her. I'm sitting closest to her. Mum leans across me and reaches out her hand to take Gran's. Lovely to see you, Mum. You're looking well? But Gran turns and frowns at Mum. Her face is blank. Who are you? My heart sinks. It's me, Lorna. Your daughter. Mum's voice wavers. Panic flutters across Gran's face. I don't have a daughter. My eyes fill with tears at Mum's crushed expression, and I blink rapidly to stop them spilling over. That's not going to be helpful to anyone. Mum quickly recovers. Of course you do. And a granddaughter. But she retracts her hand from Gran's. Gran turns to me, a spark of recognition in her eyes. Safi! I smile, trying not to look at Mum. Hi, Gran. How's that lovely man of yours? He's good. I hope you're still feeding him up. I laugh. Mum has slumped against the back of the sofa, utterly dejected. It's not a Thursday. You usually come and see me on a Thursday. Sometimes I'm shocked by how switched on Gran can be. And at others, it's like someone has snuck into the care home late at night and wiped her memory. It seems all the more cruel that she can't remember Mum when she's so lucid about other things. It's Monday, you're right. But today the police are coming. Remember last week I told you about the bodies in the garden? Gran stiffens and Mum leans forward expectantly. Why do the police need to see me? They just want to ask you a few questions, that's all, because you used to live in the house. She narrows her eyes. Just try to answer them as best you can. You spoke about a Sheila last time, and a Victor. Sheila, wicked little girl. Who is this Sheila she keeps mentioning? As much as I'd love to know more, I need to get her to focus on the topic in hand. Can you remember living in the cottage, Gran? Gran straightens up. Of course I can. I'm not fucking stupid. I'm taken aback. Gran has never spoken to me like that before, and I've never heard her swear. I know you're not stupid, I say softly. Mum's voice cuts across us. I think we should leave the questioning to the police, honey. I'm not questioning her, I say, throwing Mum a look, even though I know I am. But Mum doesn't understand how to handle Gran, and I do. The three of us fall into a terse silence. I know Mum is silently brooding that Gran forgot who she is, and I appreciate how hurtful that is, but she does it to me sometimes. Mum hasn't been to see Gran very often since she was admitted to the home. I should have warned her it can be like this. Jean hit her, Gran says suddenly, breaking the silence. I lean towards her. Who's Jean? Jean hit her. Jean hit her over the head and she fell to the ground. I hold my breath, not wanting to interrupt her flow. I can sense the tension radiating from Mum. Could it be possible that Gran does know something about the bodies after all? We wait. One beat, two. Next to me, Mum opens her mouth and I shake my head at her. No, I plead silently at her. Don't speak. I didn't know what to do. Everyone said she was wicked. Everyone said she was bad for what she did. Victor was trying to hurt us. I lean forward carefully so as not to put her off her stride. Gran, are you saying someone called Jean killed the woman at Skelton Place? I turn to glance at Mum, horrified. Victor. Sheila. I rub my temples. I can feel a headache coming on. Gran is confused and so am I. It's just the dementia talking, I tell myself. Before my last visit, I'd never heard her mention these names. Thankfully, Joy walks over to us at that moment. The police are here, she whispers, looking around to make sure the other residents haven't heard. I think you should all come with me. Chapter 13. Lorna. They follow Joy into a room just off the hallway, which has a fireplace and flocked wallpaper in duck egg blue. Safi is holding her Gran's arm, and Lorna's heart is silently breaking. Breaking not only at the sight of her mother looking so much older than the last time she'd visited 6 months ago, but the shock that she doesn't recognize her. She knows she hasn't been to visit as much as she should. It's been hard from Spain. That's what she's always told herself, anyway. Yet deep down, she acknowledges she could have done it more often if she'd really wanted to. It's only a 90-minute journey by plane. But it had been easier not to think about her mother, fading away in the care home, her brain scrambled. It had been easier instead to focus on ridiculously buffed and unsuitable toy boys. Now the guilt eats her up. She's been a terrible daughter. The two floral armchairs positioned either side of the fireplace are occupied by men, both in open-necked shirts, smart trousers, and a sheen of sweat on their faces. It's even hotter in here than it is in the day room. The older of the two, mid-40s, Lorna suspects, with receding hair, blue eyes, and a chiseled jaw, stands up when they enter. The younger man, late 20s, short and stocky with spiky hair the colour of dirty dishwater, remains seated. He's drinking what looks like a chocolate milkshake from a see-through Starbucks cup. I'm D.S. Matthew Barnes, says the older one, shaking their hands across the coffee table. And this is my colleague, D.C. Ben Worthing. We're from Wiltshire Police, CID. Ben nods to them all. She notices his gaze lingers on Safi. D.S. Barnes returns to his seat, and Joy fusses around them all, ushering them into chairs opposite the officers, taking their coffee and tea orders. Lorna and Safi flank her mother, who looks small in the chair and very confused, her fingers knitted together in her lap, her eyes darting between the two men, like a nervous child's. Lorna reaches out and takes her mum's hand for reassurance. She's relieved when Rose lets her.
Now, I don't want you to worry, Rose, says D.S. Barnes kindly. This is an informal chat. We're just gathering information at this point, like we're doing with everyone connected to the property.
He has a notebook and biro on the table in front of him. He opens the notebook and takes off the lid of his pen, ready. Her mother doesn't say anything, instead staring ahead, sipping the tea that Joy kindly brought in.
So, first, can I just have some information, Rose? Like your date of birth? Her mother suddenly looks panicked, lowering her mug. August 1939, I think.
You were born in 1943, Mum,
pipes up Lorna. She turns to D.S. Barnes. The 20th of March, 1943.
Oh, yes. Yes, 1943. In the middle of the war, you know.
Her mother takes another sip of her tea and smacks her lips together. Lorna glances over her head at Safi, who stares back at her anxiously. This is surely going to be a disaster. How can they proceed with this when her mum can't even remember her own date of birth?
And you've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Asks D.S. Barnes.
Her mother doesn't say anything, so Lorna adds, Yes, last summer. Safi fidgets in her seat. Lorna notices she's hardly touched her glass of water.
Thanks, Lorna, says D.S. Barnes, nodding to her without smiling. So, Rose, my notes say you began proceedings to rent out the cottage in April 1981.
She shakes her head. I don't know. He refers to his little black notebook.
We know that your first tenant was in June 1981. A couple who rented the house from you for 10 years. We've already spoken to them. But before that, you lived at the property for nearly 4 years. Did anyone live there with you?
I had a lodger. This is news to Lorna. She sits up straighter. She notices Safi does the same.
A lodger? Male or female?
Asks D.S. Barnes. A female lodger. Daphne. Daphne Hartle. She says the name almost with relish, like she hasn't said it in a very long time, and enjoys the way it forms on her lips. Her mother has never mentioned a Daphne before.
Can you remember what year this was? Says D.S. Barnes.
I think 1979. No, 1980. She slurps her tea noisily, some of which sloshes onto her pink jumper. Safi's hand hovers near the mug, ready to help her with it. The last year I was in the cottage.
And how old was Daphne?
She was the same age as me, I think, in her 30s, or maybe 40. Her eyes dart from side to side. I can't remember exactly.
And what happened to her?
I don't know. She left. We lost touch.
Were you friends?
Yes. Yes, we were friends. She sounds grumpy now, the way she'd sounded with Lorna when she used to ask about her dad.
And did either of you have any male friends around that time?
Her mother moves suddenly, and a splash of tea jumps from the cup and dribbles down her front. Safi is wearing a pained expression. Here, Gran, let me take the mug, she says, relief flooding her face when she has it safely in her hands and has lowered it to the table.
Rose, prompts D.S. Barnes. Male visitors?
Her mother shudders. No. No, we were scared. Victor. Lorna frowns. Victor again. Who is this Victor?
Why were you scared, Rose?
D.S. Barnes asks gently. Victor wanted to hurt the baby. She touches her soft stomach, as though remembering what it was like to be pregnant. Does she mean me? Wonders Lorna. She can't mean me. She told me my dad died before I was born. Her mother was always so overprotective when Lorna was growing up, insisting on meeting her from the school bus every evening when all her friends were allowed to walk home by themselves. She never let her wander far, always making sure that she knew where Lorna was going and what time she'd be back,
and if she was ever late, she'd ring around her friend's parents, and it was so embarrassing that Lorna made sure she was always back on time. Is that why? Because she was scared of a man called Victor. D.S. Barnes frowns.
Who is Victor? Can you remember his surname?
She shakes her head. It's all such a long time ago now. She turns to Safi and says, I don't want to answer any more questions. I want to watch Bargain Hunt. Oh, Gran, says Safi, taking her hand. It won't be long now, will it, Detective?
D.S. Barnes nods. Just a bit longer, please, Rose. Can you remember any more about Victor? Did he ever come to the cottage?
No, I don't know. She blinks rapidly. I can't remember.
Is there anything else you can tell me about Daphne?
No. Like I've already said, she lived at the cottage with me for a while, a year, I think, and then left, moved on. Yes. Yes, she moved on.
And did you have any other lodgers around that time?
No. Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Before Daphne. But she didn't stay long.
Can you remember her name?
No.
D.S. Barnes takes a deep breath. Okay, well, we'll need to look into that. And did you ever witness anyone being hurt at the cottage?
Jean hit her over the head.
Lorna's heart sinks.
D.S. Barnes glances across at his colleague and then back at her mother.
Jean? Who's Jean, Rose?
Jean hit her over the head, and she didn't get back up again.
D.S. Barnes uncrosses his legs, his face passive, but Lorna can see the twitch of excitement at the corners of his mouth. Jean hit Daphne over the head?
No.
Then who?
Confusion flits across her mother's face. She looks tired, dark circles around her eyes. I don't know. I think my mother has had enough now, don't you?
Lorna cuts in.
This feels wrong to her. How can anything her mother says be believed?
D.S. Barnes nods in defeat. Okay. He turns to Lorna. But if your mother remembers anything else, anything, no matter how insignificant it may seem, please let us know.
Lorna stands in the corridor and watches as Safi and Joy accompany her mother back to the day room. She's chattering away about Bargain Hunt, and she can still hear her voice as she rounds the corner, strong Cockney accent, even after all these years. There doesn't seem to be any lasting damage, but she's still furious with D.S. Barnes. She wants to give him a piece of her mind. She hovers in the hallway until he exits the room, Ben Worthing close behind. She hoists her handbag over her shoulder and marches up to him. Was that really necessary? She's an old woman with dementia, for crying out loud. I hope you didn't take her talk of this Victor and Jean seriously. She's confused, that's all. She doesn't know what she's saying.
D.S. Barnes looks taken aback by her outburst. We have to interview everyone who lived at the property during that time frame, he says calmly. She can't imagine him ever raising his voice. This is a serious crime, and we need as much information as we can get hold of. But yes, I understand that Rose has dementia. I won't be taking everything she says at face value. However, there could be something in what she's saying, and I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't investigate that.
My mother won't know anything. You said you spoke to the people who rented the house from her. Did they shed light on any of this?
He sighs. Not at the moment. But like I've said, we're just trying to ascertain as much as we can at this stage about who was living at the property and when. We're also working hard to identify the bodies. Once we know who they were and when exactly they died, it will be easier to... They are interrupted by the gurgling sounds of liquid being sucked through a straw, and they turn in time to see DC Worthing polishing off his takeaway milkshake. Lorna glares at him, and he has the grace to look shamefaced.
"I'll meet you in the car, Gov,"
he says, scuttling out of the building.
"Gov? Really?"
She rolls her eyes. DS Barnes notices because he says, "Deadpan." He's new. I think he's watched too many episodes of The Sweeney. Her lips twitch, but she refuses to laugh. He's not getting off that lightly. She shuffles her feet. One of her sandals is rubbing her recent blister.
"So, what happens next?"
He gives her a long look that she can't read. She wonders if it's pity.
"We'll be in touch."
Chapter 14. Safi. When we get back, Tom is still at work, so Mum says she'll start on dinner, and I take Snowy for a walk. It's still warm, the sun flickering through the trees. As I stroll past number 8, Brenda Morrison comes scurrying out, still in her sheepskin slippers.
"Oi, I want a word with you," she says, scowling.
I stop and try to smile politely, turning towards her. I've never taken to Brenda or her husband, Jack. Neither made us feel particularly welcome when we moved in, not to mention them opposing the build. They're always complaining about something: the position of our rubbish bin, the sound of the builders drilling, Snowy barking in the garden.
"How are you, Brenda?" I ask.
"Not good. I'm fed up with those journalists coming over all the time. Last week there was one in our back garden, taking photos over our fence. It's just not on. It's making my Jack's acid reflex play up."
"I'm really sorry. I hate them being here too. We've lived here nigh on 30 years and have never known the like."
"I don't know what they're hoping to achieve. There's no new information and there might not be for some time," I say. DS Barnes said earlier about trawling through missing persons between 1970 and 1990 to try to identify the bodies. It could take months.
"And I've also had the police here last week asking questions,"
she bulldozes on, as though I haven't spoken.
"And I can tell you what I told them. We've been living here over 30 years, and if two people have been murdered and buried in the garden next door, well,"
she folds her arms across her chest, "we'd have seen. Nothing gets past me." That doesn't surprise me. 30 years? So you arrived here in 1986, bought it from a lovely old couple. They wanted to move to a bungalow near their son. You didn't know my gran, Rose Gray? She wasn't living here then, but she was the landlord. I don't know if she ever came over or... But she shakes her head.
"Nope. When we moved in, a Beryl and Colin Jenkins lived in your house, and I don't remember meeting any Rose Gray."
Snowy pulls at the lead, and I bend down to stroke him. "And after them, was it Mr. and Mrs. Turner?" I ask, recalling Mrs. McNulty's conversation in the corner shop. Brenda glares at me, and just when I think she'll refuse to say, she leans towards me, and I can tell, despite her prickliness, she's enjoying having a gossip. She pulls her cream cardigan further around her skinny body. "The Turners, Valerie and Stan, moved in around 1988 or 1989. Had a dodgy son, always getting into trouble."
"Do you remember the son's name?"
"Harrison. Yes, that's it. I remember because of George Harrison. He was a wild one. Felt sorry for his mum and dad. They were older. Stan had very bad arthritis."
"Have you told the police this?"
"Of course I have. I told them last week."
I hope they've looked into the son. I make a mental note to ask DS Barnes.
"Anyway," I say, trying to sound cheerful, "there are no journalists right now. Maybe they're having a day off.
But she harumps and scurries back inside, without saying goodbye. Later, I recount my conversation with Brenda to Tom as we stand side by side at the sink, washing up our dinner things before Mum insists on doing it. She's already rearranged the cutlery drawer. I filled him in on our visit to Gran when we were eating. Mum's gone up to her room to attend to her blistered feet. I don't know why she insists on wearing heels everywhere. A silvery salmon skin sticks to the oven dish, and I take out my frustration by scrubbing hard. I'm desperate for a dishwasher, but God knows when we can start the building work again. It looks like it'll be a long time before I have my dream kitchen. Even though the garden is no longer being treated as a crime scene, and the police have said we're allowed to continue with our renovations, the builders can't come back for a few months because they've now started on another job. I can't help wondering if that's an excuse.
The sun could be an interesting line of inquiry for the police, says Tom. Maybe his parents helped him cover it up.
I notice a fleck of white paint in his hair. He came home from work and instantly changed into his decorating clothes, saying, "I can just get in another lick of paint before dinner." The banister is nearly finished, and then he wants to start on the little bedroom. But something stops me. Every time I go in there, I feel strange. It's only been since the bodies were discovered, and I know it's because the back window looks onto the garden and the gigantic hole. It's just a reminder of what happened, that's all. I know I'll get past it, once all this is over. Gran mentioned a Jean and Victor today, I say. I think she's just getting confused, but I sigh. For the first time, it made me wonder if she knows something about those bodies, like she's trying to remember something. But after speaking to Brenda, I let my words hang in the air. D.S. Barnes told us as we were leaving that the woman who sold the house to Gran back in 1977 is long dead. She had no children, but a sister whom they have spoken to. He added that they were following up with the two families who rented the house from Gran in the years between 1981 and 1990, but didn't mention the Turner's son. He also said they will be looking into Daphne Hartle and the other lodger. It sounds like they're working hard to identify the bodies, but he did say it would be a long process due to the state of decomposition. It sounds like a mammoth task.
It must be so hard for your gran, and hard to know if what she's saying actually means anything or is just ramblings due to the dementia, says Tom as he dries a plate. It nearly slips from his hand.
Careful, that's one of our only unchipped ones.
He pulls a face. It's a running joke how clumsy he is.
On the night we first met at uni in Bournemouth, he'd walk me back to my student digs after I'd had too much to drink. I could tell he was kind straight away. He took care of me, fetching me water and making me toast to nibble. I remember looking at him as he crossed my shabby living room with a tray and feeling a pang of fondness for him, this hot, slightly geeky guy with the floppy blonde hair who was trying to impress me, when he tripped over the rug and the plate and mug went flying across the room. He froze in horror, his eyes meeting mine. Then we both cracked up, and it broke the ice. Since then, he slipped on wet decking when we went to look around our first rental property with the estate agent, fallen over a tree stump and broken his ankle on a romantic walk in the woods, and only last year, tripped over Snowy and put his back out for a week. Not to mention all the glasses and plates he's dropped over the years. He says he's not coordinated because he's never got used to his long limbs and lanky frame.
Like a puppy German shepherd that's growing too fast, he'd joke.
Tom sets the plate carefully on the laminate work surface and picks up the oven dish from the rack with an exaggerated care that makes me laugh. Mum rushes into the kitchen.
She looks flustered. I've just had a great idea, she says. Why don't we look through your grand's things? All this talk of a Jean and a Victor, it's got me curious.
Her things, I say, taking the tea towel from Tom to wipe my sudsy hands.
Yes, you know, the stuff we boxed up when we were packing her Bristol house.
I frown. We gave a lot of it away to charity, her furniture and things.
Yes, yes, but we kept her personal stuff, didn't we? Her admin and so on.
She sounds impatient. I nod, remembering the envelopes and boxes of papers that were stuffed into her sideboard and we couldn't be bothered to look through, telling ourselves we'd do it at a later date. But then we forgot, and Mum went back to Spain.
What did you do with it all?
I try to think. It could be in the spare room or in the attic now. We still have a lot of unpacking to do. Mum raises an eyebrow at me as if to say, but you've been living here months. I know she would have had it all done in the first week.
Okay then, we need to find the boxes and go through them.
My heart falls. What, now? I was looking forward to a packet of minstrels in front of the telly and a light-hearted rom-com, something funny to take our minds off everything that's been going on. Her face softens.
I'm sorry, honey. I know you must be tired. I'd forgotten how knackering the second trimester is. Just show me where they are, and I'll go through them.
I'm tempted, I'm not going to lie. But I can't let her do it by herself. It wouldn't be right.
It's fine. I'll help. Come on.
I throw Tom an exasperated look over my shoulder. He smiles in sympathy and says he'll put the kettle on. We find them in the attic, the two large boxes the furthest away, crammed into a corner under the eaves. Tom has to come up to help lift them down the ladder. Then the three of us sit on the floor with a hot drink beside us and sift through them, Snowy with his head resting in Tom's lap.
God, your gran kept a lot of crap, he says, as he sorts through a pile of old receipts.
Look at this.
I hold up a tan, leather-bound book. It's a book of poems. It looks ancient. I open it. The pages are yellowing and smell musty.
Oh. Wow.
What? Asks Mum. I gently peel a pressed flower from between the pages. It's a pressed rose. It's dry and crispy, but the burnt crimson colours are still vivid. Someone she loved gave her this. I place the flower carefully back in the book and hand it to Mum. They're love poems. Mum's eyes glisten as she takes the book and turns it over in her hands. I know how she feels. Gran has always been so private, never talking about her past, her lovers, her husband. It's hard to imagine she had a life before she was a mother and a grandmother. A life in which she'd received a pressed rose in a book of poems. A life in which she was in love.
Maybe my father gave it to her, says Mum. What about old photos? Do you have any in your box?
She always did have a sparse amount, I say, remembering how I'd asked once to see some of my granddad, and she proclaimed that she hardly had any, that people didn't take that many photos in her day, which I found hard to believe. She didn't grow up in Victorian times. Have you ever seen any of your dad? I say to Mum, who's still staring at the little book of poetry. She puts it on the floor next to her feet, reluctantly.
No, never. She said they got lost in a move.
So you know nothing about him?
No, not much. She didn't like to talk about him, said it upset her too much.
She continues ferreting in the box.
She said he died before I was born, a heart attack.
We never visited any grave. I think of the man buried in the garden. For one awful moment, I wonder if it could be my granddad. I shake the thought from my mind. That's ridiculous. I can't start doubting Gran now. And the book of poetry, the dried rose. They must have been in love once. Did you ever meet any of your dad's family? I ask Mum. She shakes her head. No. Your gran always said his parents had died young, like her own, and they were both only children. And you knew nothing else about him. Mum looks up from the box and ponders this. Not really. I suppose I gave up asking. She never seemed to want to talk about him. She turns back to the box and then gives a shout of joy, making me jump. She's holding a brown A4 envelope in her hand. There's photos in here! I crawl over to where she's sitting by the window. Let me see. She pulls out a pile in different sizes and starts flicking through them. Most are of Mum in various stages of growing up, in the garden of the house in Bristol. But then she pulls out 5 or 6 square ones. Look at these, she says, handing them to me. I'm sitting almost on top of her, so eager am I to see the rare photos. They look like they were taken with one of those old Polaroid cameras, and are of Mum when she's really young, no more than 2 or 3 years old. Most are of her sitting cross-legged in what looks like the garden here, the cottage just visible in the background. One is of her and a much younger gran, slimmer than I've ever seen her, and dressed in flared trousers and a stripy tank top. Oh my God, says Mum, staring at another photo. I peer over her shoulder. It's of Mum again, as a little girl, and she's standing in front of the cottage, the frothy lilac wisteria visible above her. Bent down next to her is a woman I don't recognize. They aren't close up, so it's hard to distinguish features, but it's not Gran. Mum turns to look at me, her brown eyes wide. Who is this woman? Do you think she could be Daphne? Maybe. I take the photo from her and flip it over. On the back are the words, Lolly, April 1980, 9 Skelton Place. I frown. Who's Lolly? Me, says Mum. It's how I referred to myself. I couldn't say Lorna, apparently. I've never heard Gran call you that. Mum chuckles. I probably told her off for it. That would have been the sort of thing that embarrassed me, I reckon, as I got older. I hand the photo to Tom, who glances at it, then lets out a bark of laughter. Nice page boy haircut, Lorna. Mum used to cut it. That fringe. I scoot back to the box I was looking through and pull out an envelope, hoping to find more photographs. Instead, I find a yellowing newspaper clipping. What's this? I say, as I slide it out. I'm worried it's going to disintegrate in my hands, it's so old. It's from January 1977, in a newspaper called The Thanet Echo. What? This time Mum skittles over to me, and we both read it at the same time. A Broadstairs woman who has been missing for over a week is thought to have tragically drowned. Sheila Watts, 37, was last seen on New Year's Eve at her local pub, the Shire Horse. Late night revelers said she joined them at the beaches of Viking Bay to continue celebrations. Witnesses told police Miss Watts was on the beach at just after midnight and was spotted getting into the sea. Her clothes were found on the shore, although Miss Watts wasn't seen again. Alan Hartle, 38, a neighbour of Miss Watts, said, Sheila was a bit of a loner, kept herself to herself, although I got to know her quite well. Because it was New Year's Eve, she decided to join us for a drink in our local, and then came with us to the beach. She was the only one who got in the sea. We were busy drinking and had forgotten all about her. It was only when she failed to return home that I realized what must have happened and alerted the police. Coast guards have scoured the bay to no avail, and local police issued a statement to say they believe Miss Watts died of death by misadventure. I turned to Mum.
Sheila, do you think this is who Gran was talking about today?
She looks as puzzled as I feel.
Maybe she knew her.
In Broadstairs, but I thought Gran was from London. I think she lived all over before I was born. I pass the piece to Tom, who reads it. The fading light from the leaded windows casts a shadow on one side of his face. It has the effect of making his nose look crooked. He hands me back the article. "This has to be important," he says, glancing from me to Mum and voicing what we're all thinking. "Why else would you keep an article for 40 years?
Chapter 15. Theo. Theo has been watching his dad closely since he stumbled upon that newspaper article last week, finding excuses to pop over to the soulless mansion in between shifts, plucking up the courage to broach the subject to the couple in Wiltshire. His dad has never been open with Theo at the best of times, but lately, every time Theo turns up at his house, his dad acts as though he's an intruder, questioning him on why he's come over. Just once, Theo would like his dad to look even a little bit pleased to see him. But he's promised Jen he'd ask him. Jen, who wouldn't be afraid to ask her warm, open family anything. So, here he is again, Tuesday lunchtime, before he starts at the restaurant. Why is it so bloody hard to broach the subject with his father? He's a grown man. But when he's around him, he feels like that unsure teenager again, obeying his mother's wishes to keep his mouth shut, to do what his father says so as not to upset him, to keep things on an even keel like she always did, to stop his father getting angry. "I don't need any more food," his dad snaps when Theo walks into the kitchen with his trusty cool bag filled with a chicken curry and a cottage pie. "I've got a freezer full of them. I eat at the golf club most nights anyway." Honestly, Theo doesn't know why he fucking bothers. God, he'd love to tell his father where to go. But even though his mum has been dead for 14 years, he can't bring himself to do it. She'd be disappointed in him. He knows it. "Actually," says Theo, dumping the bag on the table, "I came here to ask you something." His heart pounds beneath his t-shirt. He imagines Jen behind him, encouraging him to continue. "What's that then?" His father has one of his golf clubs in his hand, and he's buffing the end of it with a rag. He tried to teach Theo golf once, when he was 13. He bought him a set of his own irons and taught him the name of each one. Theo had hated every minute of it, but kept it up for more than a year to please him. But when his father realised Theo was never going to be any good, he lost interest in teaching him. Theo takes a deep breath. "Last week, when I came over, I found a newspaper article on your desk. It was about this couple from Wiltshire who were doing some kind of renovations and found two skeletons in their garden. You'd underlined two women's names, and then there were the words, 'Find her.'" His father stops polishing his club, but doesn't look up. Instead, his muscular shoulders tense, and the tendon in his neck bulges. "Have you been snooping around my things?" "No, of course not." His dad stands up, golf club still in hand. For a wild moment, Theo wonders if he's going to smack him with it. His father is looking at him now. His blue eyes are icy. "Then mind your own fucking business." Theo tries to hide his shock. His dad hasn't spoken to him like that in years. "Who are you trying to find? Did you not hear me?" His dad moves two paces towards him. His face has darkened. The old familiar fear resurfaces in Theo. "I'm not that scared little kid anymore," he reminds himself. "Why won't you talk about it? Maybe I can help." His dad lets out a nasty sounding laugh. "You? Why are you such a prick?" thinks Theo, but he stands his ground. refuses to move back towards the door. Yes, me. Do you know the couple from Wiltshire? Of course not. Then why the article? He puts the golf club down, leaning it against the kitchen table, and Theo lets out a small sigh of relief. I just used it to write on. Not that it's got anything to do with you. He's lying. His dad must think he's an idiot. So what does find her mean? Why does everything have to have some hidden meaning with you? What is it you really want to ask me, huh? What is this really all about? He stares at Theo, his mouth set hard. I'm a grown man, and I don't have to run everything I do past you. Do you understand? Theo stares back. What are you hiding, Dad? Because I know you're hiding something. I'm not playing games, says Theo, trying to keep his voice even. I'm asking you about that article, that's all. You've seemed very preoccupied lately, like something's troubling you. The only thing troubling me is you, he snaps. Theo takes a deep breath. There's no point in arguing with his father when he's in this mood. He holds his hands up. Fine, I'll leave you to it then. He picks up the bag from the table. I take it you don't want these? His dad scowls in response. Then I'll take them. Jen and I will eat them. He marches out the kitchen with the bag and doesn't look back until he's behind the wheel of his Volvo. He half hopes his dad will follow him to apologise. But, of course, he doesn't. Theo dumps the cool bag on the passenger seat and sits for a few minutes without turning on the ignition. Guilt raining down on him, as it always does. Was he out of order? Should he have handled it differently? Your dad's just old school, his mum used to say gently. He's not very good at showing his emotions, but he loves us. He was never sure if she was trying to convince him or herself. Theo knows he shouldn't be surprised his dad hasn't revealed anything. After his mum died, Theo had tried talking about her, but his dad had refused to be drawn, burying his grief under even more layers of bitterness and anger, like a well-cooked lasagna. And now this extra mystery, the two dead bodies in a Wiltshire garden more than 200 miles away, and the words, find her, in his father's sprawling handwriting. It finally hits him that he'll never get answers from his dad. It's been too many years, too many unanswered questions. He's just going to have to do some digging of his own. But where to start? He thinks later, much later, after his shift at the restaurant has ended. Jen is fast asleep upstairs, but he's still buzzing. His body is dog-tired, his feet ache after standing up all evening, but his mind is too active and he can't switch off. Google, he thinks. He'll start there. He goes to his laptop, which lives on the dining room table in their two-bedroom Victorian terrace. The glow of the screen, the only light in the room, reflects back at him from the French windows that lead to the garden. He starts off typing in saffron cutler. A few articles pop up about the bodies found in her garden, but nothing that wasn't in the cutting on his dad's desk. He continues scrolling. Lots of news stories from someone called Ewan Cutler, who writes for one of the Red Tops. Rose Gray is also a dead end. He has no clue which of the many Rose Grays could be the one referred to in the article he found. Then he types in his father's name. A number of entries pop up. His dad is a very eminent man. It takes Theo a while to sift through it all, and he almost gives up. He doesn't know what he's expecting to find. There's a page detailing his long and successful medical career. And then he notices another article about a private practice set up in 1974. It's accompanied by a grainy black and white photo of his much younger father standing with another man at some black tie do. He peers more closely at the screen. There is a caption underneath. Practice partner Larry Knight. That's strange, thinks Theo. As far as he's aware, his dad never had a partner at the small private clinic he used to run, and which he sold when he retired 6 years ago. He types his dad's name and Dr. Larry Knight into Google. A few articles from a range of medical journals pop up. It sounds like they parted ways about 4 years after setting up the clinic. Theo wonders why. His dad has always been an enigma to him. There's so much about his past that he doesn't know. Maybe Larry Knight might give him some answers. He realises he's grasping at straws. There's nothing here to link his dad to the bodies in Wiltshire. But maybe Larry Knight might give him some insight into what his dad's life was like before he met Theo's mum. He might even know Rose Grey. He rubs his eyes. He's exhausted yet wired at the same time. He can't tear his eyes away from the screen, even though there is no new information there. He blinks away his tiredness, but his dad's name swims in front of him. Dr. Victor Carmichael.